from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, gun control advocates say that last week's tragic theater shootings in Aurora, Colorado underscore the need for new and tougher firearm laws. Their adversaries in the gun rights community see things differently. If someone in the theater had been armed, they argue, lives might have been saved. Will the massacre lead to legislative action, and how will the politics of guns play out in the presidential election? Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In light of the tragic shootings in Aurora, Colorado, discussion has once again been sparked nationwide on questions related to gun control. 12 people were killed and 58 wounded in those shootings after James Holmes allegedly opened fire on Friday during the screening of the film The Dark Knight Rises. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg yesterday called on President Obama and his presumptive challenger Mitt Romney to lay out a strategy for combating gun violence in the United States. California Senator Dianne Feinstein called for a ban on assault weapons. Arizona Senator John McCain expressed skepticism of any additional gun control, and Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, a Democrat, stated that stricter gun laws might not have mattered because James Holmes, the alleged shooter, appeared determined to commit the crime. This Forum Hour, we want to focus our attention, in wake of the tragedy in Aurora, Colorado, once again on renewal of the gun control debate. Joining us from Springfield, Virginia, is John Vileco. He is Director of Federal Affairs for GOA, Gun Owners of America. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you. Also good to have Garen Winnemut with us. And Garen Winnemut is director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at University of California, Davis. And he joins us from the state capitol in Sacramento. And welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Dr. Winnemut, I'm going to begin with you. And let me just begin with some information from a recent Gallup poll. Now, I'm not sure, and no one is, how this is going to affect the whole dialogue or conversation about gun control. But the Gallup poll said, well, let me just give you some numbers. Increased satisfaction with the status quo on gun rights, 2001, 38%. Now, or that is just recently, that's gone up to 50%. So in other words, there are more people satisfied with the status quo. And although we don't know how this is going to affect things, violence and gun violence is down in this country.
2 points. I think the satisfaction may actually reflect a sense of futility, of having given up. Number two, while overall rates of gun violence have been stable across the country, there are places where rates of gun violence are increasing substantially. To pick just one example, Chicago is seeing a 40% increase in homicide this year over last. It's a dynamic situation, and it will be important for us to keep focused on current data more than looking to the past.
What about the data that says that 53% favor the expiration of assault weapons? We're talking about the possibility of reinstatement of the ban on assault weapons. As I mentioned, Senator Feinstein has come out in favor of that, and a number of other legislators. Do we need to separate these combat weapons, magazine drums, and weapons that are used largely for combat from just ordinary street guns?
I think that makes sense. There are weapons in widespread circulation that have almost no legitimate use. Similarly, there are accessories like high-capacity magazines for which sports can and have been invented, but which have no legitimate use in ordinary civilian life. It is, I think, absolutely possible, whether we're talking about firearms or firearm owners, to identify subsets that are at high risk and take action to regulate those subsets without interfering with the activities of legitimate owners or of weapons that have widespread legitimate use.
John Vileco, let me go to you on that. Are you at all comfortable with that distinction or that dichotomy?
Not at all. In fact, if we begin to regulate subsets of firearms for people like Dianne Feinstein, the subsets will continue till there are none left, because she would support banning, for instance, all handguns. So right now she has focused on so-called assault weapons, which incidentally, the assault weapons that she's talking about might look like military guns, but they're actually not military guns. They're semi-automatic weapons that fire one round per one pull of the trigger. So they're not machine guns, which is actually an assault weapon. But no, we would not.
But excuse me, if you put a drum magazine on a gun, it operates almost like a machine. It does operate like a machine gun virtually.
Well, it's still a semi-automatic weapon. And if we start banning semi-automatic weapons, then, you know, most firearms, most modern firearms are in fact a semi-auto, but that doesn't even get to the root of the problem. I'll go back to something that you opened the show with, that a lot of people are satisfied with the status quo in this country. Well, actually, a lot of gun owners are not satisfied with the status quo, and there's a strong belief that the status quo is leading to these the proliferation of these gun-free zones, which turn into criminal safe zones. Whereas in Colorado, it was a business decision. That theater has a national policy against firearms. But the fact is, if there were a concealed carry holder in that theater with a 45 caliber handgun and a well-placed shot, that attack could have been stopped as soon as it began, and instead of lasting until 12 people were murdered and another 59 injured.
You must be aware, though, of a lot of national sentiment that says, and all of these incidents, of course, and these tragic episodes are different, but the shooting of Congresswoman Gabby Gifford and what happened at Fort Hood and in your own neighborhood at Virginia Tech, they seem to conflate in many people's minds with the need to do something to literally control weaponry, Columbine and the Beltway sniper, and even this most recent tragedy. And you say what to that sense that people have that there are just too many guns and they're too easily accessible?
Well, you know, there's a very natural and understandable understanding belief that we want to be safe. I want to be safe. I want my five children, who actually wanted to go to the Batman movie at midnight here in Virginia one night. We all want to be safe. Now, the question is, what makes us safe? Will restricting the gun rights for the law-abiding, will banning the so-called assault weapons, will that make us any safer? Will closing the so-called gun show loophole make us any safer? Or are those things just an illusion of safety? And will citizens, law-abiding citizens who can carry a firearm concealed, will that make us safer? And we would say the latter, that in fact, one thing that has been shown to stop shootings from escalating into mass shootings is the presence of an armed victim.
And let me go back to you, Dr. Wintermute, on this. I mean, are we necessarily made safer?
Well, exactly. So There's a point actually in which I would agree with a statement that Mr. Vallejo made about gun policy not representing the wishes of gun owners, but I take the data very differently. Gun policy is set in the United States not to represent the interests of the general public, or even to represent the interests of the majority of gun owners. Gun policy in the United States reflects the interests of a small group of radicals and legislators who, in my judgment, agree with them. The vast majority of gun owners, and I'm going to give you some specific examples, support much of what might be called a, quote, gun control, unquote, agenda. For example, by margins of 75% or better, gun owners, not the general public, believe that people who've been convicted of violent misdemeanors like assault and battery should not be allowed to purchase or possess firearms, that people who've been convicted of alcohol offenses like driving under the influence should not be allowed to purchase or possess firearms, and federal gun policy is completely silent on guns and alcohol. Even NRA members, as a group, by a margin of 70%, support background checks at gun shows. I happen to agree with Mr. Vallejo that the problem with undocumented anonymous gun purchasing is not limited to gun shows, and your readers might be interested, sorry, your listeners might be interested to know that something like 40% of all gun purchases in the United States are made outside the regulatory framework that applies to retailers. These purchases are cash in a handshake. They are anonymous and undocumented. They can take place in less than a minute. I've watched it happen
hundreds of times.
And also
buy thousands of bullets, as this killer allegedly did off the Internet.
Ammunition purchases are, as a practical matter, not regulated. I go to gun shows a lot and used to take photographs at gun shows a lot, and you can watch people. They will roll up with the sort of four-wheeled carts that you use to get plywood at a home supply store, and they will put several thousand rounds of ammunition on that cart, and they'll get several carts take them out. There's a quote in the press this morning from the executive director of the Colorado branch of the gun owners, saying, and I'm quoting directly here, "I call 6,000 rounds of ammunition running low," unquote. That's the kind of thinking that lies behind current American gun policy. And I think, frankly, the situation we face is well summed up in somewhat archaic language, but is well summed up by Edmund Burke, who simply said, "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing." If people of good heart, gun owners and non-gun owners alike, are not willing to rise up and repudiate the kind of radicalism that drives current gun policy, we will continue to have the policies that we have now.
Well, in all fairness, I think, John Vileko, GOA, that is your organization, the Gun Owners of America, have indeed on a number of occasions called for more restrictions on gun rights and ending the private sales and things that you see as having nothing to do with this particular killing and shootings that went on in Aurora.
Sorry. Is there ever a case in which gun owners has called for increasing background checks?
Well, it's my understanding that that's the case. Perhaps you can disabuse me of that, John Vileko.
No, that actually is not the case. In fact, we would be very much opposed for the federal government to be in a position to regulate all private sales, which is really what we're talking about, is an almost unprecedented shift of power away from the individual to the federal government, in that individuals would, in effect, be treated as if they were federally licensed gun dealers, which they are not. And private citizens don't have that type of relationship with the government, where when I want to sell a gun to another private individual, that we first have to go to Attorney General Eric Holder to get approval from the FBI before that sale can go through. And if, you know, if we have a massive shift of power like that, you know, we would lose a lot of the liberty that we now enjoy, and we in fact would not be one whit safer from people like the shooter in Colorado.
Well, is 3,000 rounds of ammunition running low? Is that 6,000 rounds of ammunition?
Well, as someone who can go through several thousand rounds in a weekend with some friends, no, it's not unusual for people to buy ammunition in bulk, just like it's not unusual for people to buy a lot of products that are very expensive but a little bit cheaper when they're bought in bulk. And ammunition has, you know, a shelf life that will outlast the owner. So no, it's not unusual. And again, if we restrict things like ammunition purchases or gun purchases, you know, all of these things are done to make us feel safer. But will they make us safer? And our argument is no. And we would agree with Edmund Burke that for evil to triumph, good men need do nothing. And what we would say is that good men need to be trained in firearms ownership and firearms handling and be ready to thwart an attack against themselves, their loved ones, and even people who don't like guns can benefit from having an armed person in a place like that movie theater.
Michael, what about good men? Let me just bring this into a little bit of a different focus, because I think we have another important question here in addition to safety, and that is the necessity or the imperative to speak out on behalf of politicians. Now, Mayor Bloomberg has said that both presidential candidates need to say something and state something in terms of a position. And it would appear, at least on the face of it, and I'm wondering, John Vileka, what your response is to this. I know that you're not in favor of Mayor Bloomberg's sentiments here, but it would appear on the face of it that both candidates, in not saying anything, are perhaps afraid of the politics or afraid of the consequence that would result. Since Terry McAuliffe, after Al Gore lost, said, don't even talk about this issue. You know, the NRA is too powerful. And we know, for example, historically, that Romney signed an assault weapon ban in Massachusetts when he was governor, and President Obama had promised to reinstate that ban on assault weapons in his 2008 campaign. Regardless of what their positions are, and they're adverse to your position, shouldn't they feel free to speak out and take a position without feeling they're going to lose politically?
Well, sure, they should speak their mind, and we encourage them to do so. And President Obama, while he may be somewhat muted on domestic gun control policy in response to Aurora, he has a very ambitious and aggressive gun control agenda that he's pursuing even on a world stage. Right now, this week, the UN is wrapping up an arms trade treaty that President Obama has voiced support for and will sign and send to the Senate that can do a lot of the things that we're talking about here today. So he doesn't have to bother with Congress, and he's done that on several issues, just going around the Congress completely and using presidential directives and executive orders to achieve a gun control agenda a little bit more below the radar without actually having a bill go through the Congress.
Well, I'd like actually to get Garen Wintemute to also comment on the politics of this, but I wonder what you say to the arguments that you're hearing here, Dr. Wintemute. That is, if a couple of people had been packing 45s, perhaps they would have shot and killed this killer in the theater in Aurora. And also, we hear from those who are against gun control that the Norway mass murderer, for example, killed 77 people, and this is a country that has very strict gun controls.
Sure. First, with regard to Aurora, the theater's policies notwithstanding, I think it's stretches credibility to argue that there weren't armed people in that theater just because gun carrying is fairly common in Colorado. I go back to the Gabby Giffords case where we learned after the fact that the armed man at the scene had the presence of mind not to shoot because he would have shot the wrong guy. The idea that let me take this from another angle. What we have learned over and over again, whether one looks within a society geographically, between societies, within a society over time, is that the increase in prevalence of gun ownership and gun use in public is associated with increases and not decreases in violence. And if I could go to the politics, I have a different take on this that your listeners may find somewhat objectionable. I've been doing this work for 30 years, and for 30 years, people have been saying, well, surely this will be the event that will lead to some watershed change. Columbine happened, and everybody said Columbine will be enough, and it wasn't enough. Virginia Tech happened, everybody said this will be it. Virginia Tech wasn't enough. Gabby Giffords wasn't enough. I suspect that Aurora will not be enough. Fundamentally, the problem is this. For all the blame the NRA and the gun radical lobby deserve, I think they are also scapegoated. I think that politicians and, most importantly, all the rest of us use the boogeyman, the powerful gun lobby, to justify our own lack of action. If we are not willing as individuals, as people who value a civil society, a society where responsibilities come along with rights, if we are not willing to make a demand for and act on that demand for a civil society, we can't expect our politicians to do it for us. And that vacuum will be occupied by the people who feel the interest closest to home. And at the moment, that happens to be the people on the radical side of the gun-owning camp.
Well, let me do this. I want to invite the listeners to join in this conversation, and you have an ample opportunity to do that in a number of ways. You can, of course, join us by phone. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we welcome your phone calls. That number is 866-733-6786. Please feel free to call us with any questions or comments you might have. Again, at 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or by going to our Facebook page. And let me, in fact, go to some of these Facebook page comments. Matt writes, I think the gun industry is similar to the tobacco industry in that they make it very difficult to curb the supply. So the way to enhance public safety is to reduce the demand for guns. This is done through educating the public, especially the younger generation, that there's no glamour in using guns. If we can reduce demand for guns, then the gun makers will turn away from making guns, just as the tobacco companies change their business once the demand's decreased due to understanding of health consequences. Well, a lot of people do say, John Vileko, that this is a public health issue, and you've been talking about safety. Reduce the number of guns, there's more safety?
Well, you know, there's an important fundamental difference between tobacco and guns that I think that writer missed, and that is if you smoke, eventually, if you don't die of something else, you will die of smoking. That's a fact. You're going to die of lung cancer. If you carry a firearm, you might live. Whereas otherwise, if you didn't, in a certain situation where if you were under attack, you might have been killed. So the whole tobacco, guns, public safety issues, there's only really one side in terms of health to cigarettes, and it's bad. There's two sides to public health with respect to firearms, and one side is good in that it protects lives. And what we're saying is that the good side far outweighs the criminal misuse of firearms. And if you try to lower the number of law-abiding citizens who carry guns, you will actually see an increase in the number of crimes committed against innocent victims.
Then, Karen Wintermute, I imagine you see this different perspective as far as a public health issue?
Well, I do. And first off, I'll make 2 points. One with regard to gun ownership and risk for death. We did a study here in California where we looked at all the people who purchased handguns in a particular year. We knew almost to the day when they acquired the handgun. We knew when that, if you will, exposure started. What we learned was that risk for violent death didn't go down. It went up. It went up both for men and for women. In this conversation today, we have not yet talked about suicide, which is more common, again, by half than homicide involving firearms. And in that particular study, we learned that for women who purchased handguns, in the year following the purchase, the most common cause of death, not the most common cause of violent death or injury death, the most common cause of death was gun suicide. Now, to go back to Matt's point about firearms and tobacco, the analogy is useful to some extent, but not completely. But here, I think, is the fundamental point that joins the two. Like cigarettes, guns are consumer products. They are made by an industry that has a primary interest in turning a profit. The case with cigarettes in the 80s, the firearms industry has done research and learned, gee, our traditional market is saturated. Let's start targeting gun sales to women. So firearms were designed and given names that were intended, given designs and names intended to appeal to women. Didn't work. The prevalence of ownership has not gone up among women. But Matt's fundamental point that both guns and cigarettes are products with hazards, that both of those products can be regulated, and that public health will benefit as a result, is entirely valid.
Well, we're coming up on a break, and we're going to continue this conversation. We're going to bring your calls and emails in, and again, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment and join us that way, or go to our Facebook page. And the number again, toll-free, is 866-733-6786. We're talking with Garen Wintermute, who is director of the Violence Prevention Research Program, University of California, Davis, with us from Sacramento, and also with John Vileko, who is with us from Springfield, Virginia, director of Federal Affairs for Gun Owners of America. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The Colorado shootings have apparently renewed the gun control debate, and gun control advocates are saying that last week's tragic theater shootings in Aurora, Colorado, underscore the need for newer and tougher firearm laws. Their adversaries in the gun rights community see things quite differently. If someone in the theater had been armed, they argue, lives might have been saved. And will the massacre lead to legislative action? And how will the politics of guns play out in the presidential election? You were talking about all that with Garen Wintemute, who's director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis, and with John Vileko, who is director of federal affairs with the Gun Owners of America. Let me read some of your comments before we go to your calls. Listener points out, anyone notice that this young man and the young man accused of killing so many in Arizona and maiming the congresswoman were seen as troubled by folks in the colleges they attended, yet no one notified the police? I think that might also be said about Virginia Tech. There have to be better warning systems on these. I think whether you're for gun control or against gun control, that goes without saying. Here are some people who are both for and against. Enrique writes, gun control, no thanks. Several years ago, I heard a woman screaming for her life outside my house. I grabbed my gold cup and ran outside, saw a man on top pounding her head into the concrete, blood all over. I yelled at the guy, pointed at his head, and amazingly, he stopped pounding her head. Took about 12 seconds. The police arrived 5 minutes later. Case closed. Live woman, man in jail. Another listener, Dawn, writes, stricter laws only impact law-abiding citizens, not criminals. Criminals do not follow laws. That is the definition of a criminal. Psychopaths do not follow laws. That is the definition of a psychopath. If law-abiding citizens were allowed to be armed, we would be able to protect ourselves and our families, and criminals would think twice before behaving in this manner. Eamon says, if guns kept people safer, we'd be allowed to carry automatic weapons on commercial flights. If the solution to all our problems with violence was to meet them with more violence or the threat thereof, we'd have been living in a perfect society a long time ago. The Second Amendment has long outlived its original purpose, unless you think Timothy McVeigh was some sort of hero, and it is now causing more problems than it solves. And maybe Ted sums it up here when he says, guns harm more Americans than they protect. The higher number of guns in our neighborhood, the higher the frequency of gun violence and gun accidents. However, many, many Americans feel insecure without personal firearms. It's like a bad marriage where fear of being alone prevents you from getting a divorce. And Pam says, I'm stunned by the utter lack of any political or legislative response to this latest gun massacre. The NRA has apparently so utterly cowed every elected official that the whole subject of a reasonable gun measure cannot even be discussed. Why should anyone outside of the military have access to assault weapons? What sportsman or homeowner needs 100-round clips? I'm sick of hearing our alleged representatives, including those I support, call for prayers and healing. How about laws that would actually make us all safer? And, of course, John Vileko's position is they're not going to make us safer. And, John Vileko, I wonder how you respond to a couple of these comments before we go to our callers. This is let me just read both of these. This is Dee, first of all, who says, for those who say the deaths might have been avoided if someone in the theater had a gun, the shooter had practically every inch of his body covered with protective armor, so I have my doubts that he could have been stopped by another shooter. Add to that a smoke canister to obscure the audience's sight and cause great irritation. Again, even if you had a gun, your ability to shoot accurately would have been practically impossible and possibly could have even added to more deaths and injuries. And Malcolm says, this current pro-gun spokesperson's argument that an open carry policy would have saved lives is equivalent to saying that a group of people sickened with typhoid would be saved by introducing into the site someone with the Black Plague.
Okay. Well, in terms of the first one, sure, he had body armor, but I would be happy to equip someone with the exact same body armor and see if they can still be standing after being hit with a .45 caliber firearm. They would not. It could break a rib. It could do a lot of damage and certainly stop an attacker. Maybe not kill the attacker, but stop the attacker long enough for other people to get involved and subdue him.
Yeah, but the emailer's right. You have all that smoke from the canister. It would certainly make it difficult, even with a good sharpshooter.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Any situation like that is going to be mass chaos, mayhem. It's going to be difficult. No one is suggesting that it would be an easy thing to defend your life or to defend the lives of those around you, but it's just something that we ought to have the right to do. Would a gun have stopped this killer? I don't know. I wasn't there. Could it have? Sure. It certainly could have, and I was struck that even Dr. Wintemute did not acknowledge in his comments before any positive aspect of firearms, that they could actually provide a benefit to society under any situation.
Would you concede that point, Garen Wintemute? I mean,
positive aspects?
Yeah, sure. That there are people who save lives because they have firearms.
So yes to both. And we all know, or it would have been solved, that this is not an easy problem. There are clearly cases in which the timely use of a firearm has saved a life. The balance, as at least one of your correspondents pointed out, however, is towards loss of life. Let me give you another anecdote. It's one that's been in the news recently. We just did a study of deaths and injuries from stray bullets. And here's a case just from a couple weeks ago, and I'll make this very brief. So a 7-year-old girl is out in front of her own house with her mom. They have a little homemade stand, and they're selling candy to neighbors. It brings to mind the lemonade stand that I suspect many of us had when we were kids. Gunfire breaks out down the block. The 7-year-old girl breaks for the house, is shot as she's running for the house, and dies right there a few minutes later in her mother's arms. Now, that 7-year-old girl's name was Heaven. And I would ask your listeners to think about all the love and all the hope and all the aspiration that goes into a mother's naming her baby girl Heaven. That's gone.
Let me bring our call. You wanted to respond, though, John Vileka. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the problem with comparing only deaths with in terms of criminal and accidents and gun rates is that it doesn't account for the lives saved by guns where no one is killed, which is actually what we all want. And I think it was last week or the week before, a 71-year-old man in Florida took on 2 armed thugs who came into the establishment, and he was able to subdue them until the police came, and no one was shot, no one was killed. All the lives were protected because this 71-year-old man had a concealed firearm.
Here's a listener, Kent, who says, I, for one, can think of nothing less safe than a bunch of 45-packing concealed carry self-appointed sheriffs ready to open fire on a crowd. Open gun battles between citizens is not what the Second Amendment sought to foster. I want to actually bring our callers in, and let's begin, Gary, with you. Good morning, Gary.
Yes, I applaud Mayor Bloomberg in his attempt to curb gun violence. I used to live in New York City back in the 70s, and when there was about 1,800 murders a year. I think New York is down to about 300-some murders a year because they're very strict on guns. You carry a gun in New York, they catch you with it. It's not you go to jail, which is great. One thing that people seem to forget about is the huge amount of medical costs caused by gun violence in this country. It's millions of dollars. The people in Colorado that were shot are probably going to have to pick up those medical expenses. Where do they start getting the bills from the hospitals for the treatment? Developed democracies in Europe and Japan are no less free than we are. They have less than 200 gun violent killings a year. Less than 200. We have 10,000, another 30,000 people wounded. I've been a gun owner. I lived in Alaska when I was 13 to 15 years old, and I was a kid. I enjoyed having a bolt-action rifle and a little 22 Ruger single six. But as I got older, I started liking theater, art, girls. You know, I put away childish things. John Stockman, Ronald Reagan's budget director, made a statement some time ago, about a year ago. He said, guns have as much relevant in today's society as spittoons have in today's society. I am simply disgusted with the proliferance of guns, and I'm really fed up, and I'm 65 years old.
Let me ask John Vileka, and thank you for your comments, Gary, but I'm interested in what John Vileka has to say, particularly about the comparison to Europe, although I brought up Norway before. But for the most part, Europe, it can be argued, has a lot less homicides, and they have a lot fewer guns.
They do. They do indeed have fewer homicides. But let's, if we could, take guns out of the picture. Take all the gun murders off the table, and the United States still has a higher murder rate than those other countries with firearms and non-firearms-related murders combined. So do we have a violence problem? Sure.
Well, actually, here's a caller, Casey, I think, who's right on point here. Casey, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm wondering why we don't ban violent crimes and murders.
Well, they're technically against the law, Casey, in case you hadn't seen the statutes here. But Darren, you wanted to, Garen Wendemute, you wanted in here. Yeah.
That's been done already. But to the point of comparison with Europe and other societies, Canada, Australia, countries to which we, I think, like to compare ourselves, we actually are not more violent than those societies. If you look at rates of assaultive violence, In many of the countries to which we like to compare ourselves, rates of assaultive violence are actually higher than they are here in the United States. We are not more violent, and it's important that people understand that. What's different about violence in the United States is that we use firearms at higher rates than other countries do. It doesn't change the rate of violence. It changes the consequences. And if I can sum that up very quickly, when's the last time anybody heard or read about a drive-by knifing? Weapons make a difference.
Well, here's John who writes, I find that non-shooters don't understand how much ammunition is shot in a month by a firearm owner. I belong to a Monday night shooting league, like a bowling league. And one Monday night, I shoot nearly 200 rounds. I also practice and shoot at weekends. 6,000 rounds of different calibers sounds about right for a 3 to 6 month supply. What we need is more mental health covers to help this man and the fellow in Oakland catch them before they prepare. Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll bring April in. April, hi.
Hi. I couldn't agree more with the previous caller. I have two points to make, one of which is working in mental health. I can say honestly that I think that perhaps the easier thing for people to do sometimes is to buy guns, when in fact it's a lot harder and a lot more financially prohibitive for people to get to adequate mental health, into adequate mental health systems. And going to the police and saying, oh, somebody is acting odd, doesn't really do much. So there's not much that most of the colleges could do unless they have a distinct threat against someone else. So I think that's point number one. Point number two is, being a longtime, you know, resident of Oakland, I can say, well, it's great that there's all this legislation that could be done, but the practical application of it's another matter. When you can't even get the police to show up when somebody is being beaten half to death outside your door, and the way that you get them to show up is to say, do you need me to go outside and be a vigilante, or are you guys going to show up? That doesn't give me a lot of confidence that the government saying, I'm sorry, guns aren't a possibility, is really going to do much besides take guns out of the wrong hands.
Well, Garen, so, I'm sure you can understand. I mean, the police response time in Oakland, we just did a program on it Thursday, is about 17 seconds less than it is in big cities throughout the country. If you're a citizen there, you want police response, and if you don't get it, maybe you have to take the law into your own hands.
Right. I could not agree more. Over the course of our history, one of the smartest things we did as a country was make the decision that we were going to legitimize the use of force by trained professionals, the police. There was a time when this country did not have police, and we worked very hard to create a professional police force. It was a smart decision, and it still is. We need those trained professionals. We probably need more of them than we have. We certainly need them to be more available than they are. Here in California, where we have systematically defunded local government, where we have cities declaring bankruptcy right and left, this is a real problem. The solution to the problem is not to arm a bunch of unprofessionals as vigilantes. The solution to the problem is to provide adequate support for the professionals to whom we've given this responsibility.
Well, we have a caller on from Foster City, Nathan. Nathan, you're a gun owner and you support gun laws, huh?
Yeah, I'm a former Marine and gun owner, and I believe that there should be stricter gun laws so that, you know, the civilians that want to own guns have to be looked at carefully, have good background checks, so that it's harder for them to get a gun. So if they want to, you know, exercise it properly and responsibly to go sports shooting, it should be tougher for them to do that. It'll increase their responsibility. It'll increase the training that they receive. And one quick comment about ammunition. For anyone that goes sports shooting, it's not unusual to have a lot of ammunition because, you know, you burn through it pretty quickly.
And what do you say, John Vallejo, to the argument you're hearing from Nathan?
A couple of things. One, the idea that only armed professionals, should be the ones dealing with crime, and this also goes back to Dr. Whitmey's comments, but I think it applies to both. That's fine. You know, if I go to the movies with my five children and my wife, if you guys want to provide me with armed security, I will leave my gun at home and be happy to do it. But we don't have that luxury. The police are not our armed personal protection. They're not there. The police, no matter how you slice it, they're historians. They come to the scene after the fact. They try to figure out who did it and catch the bad guys. The only people at the scene of the crime are going to be the criminals and the victims most of the time.
Well, we have a lot of emails just questioning the very idea that an armed person in a theater would have actually saved lives. There's a lot of skepticism on that point, which has been a main point of yours, at least as far as the Aurora tragedy, John Vallejo.
Well, I would point them back again to that recent incident in Florida where two armed men burst into an establishment. A 71-year-old person armed with a handgun was able to stop them. Gun owners stop crimes. Even in the lowest estimates that we have seen over the years.
Do you have statistics on that? Excuse me for interrupting, but do you have statistics as opposed to anecdotal?
Sure. The Clinton Justice Department found that firearms were used successfully in self-defense in excess of 600,000 times per year.
Oh, that's simply not true. The estimates have the federal government surveys put the figure for all forms of defensive gun use at under 100,000. There is estimates by others go as high as 2.5 million. There's a criminologist in Florida, but it's been pointed out about his work, which is based on a small survey, that if you buy his result, 2.5 million defensive gun uses in a year, you have to buy an extrapolation from a very similar survey to the point that something like 600,000 people in the United States have had direct personal contact with space aliens. Michael, if I could go back and join a couple of comments. Nathan's about background checks and an earlier comment about criminals don't follow the law, and if you have laws, only the law-abiding will follow them. Background checks are a good example of where that's not true. And we have research data to prove that. Here in California, some years ago, the state broadened its criteria for prohibiting gun purchase to include people who had been convicted of violent misdemeanors. And we were able to look at a whole bunch of people who had been convicted of violent misdemeanors and then sought to purchase handguns. One group of people got their handguns under the old law. The other group of people did not because the law had changed and they were trying a year or two later. All of these people are convicted violent criminals. The risk of committing a new crime involving guns or violence when the purchase was denied was decreased by 30%. These are criminals who
wouldn't have helped in Aurora, Colorado. However, Holmes had no record whatsoever.
Of course not. And if we try and make federal policy to address an individual case, we will never win.
Well, that gets back to another important point, and I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on this, Garen Wintemute, because you had said earlier that you might be looked at as a maverick and saying maybe one ought to almost give up on trying to blame the NRA or defeat the NRA or words to that effect. I hope I'm not misrepresenting you here.
You are, but finish your thought, and we'll come back to it.
Well, okay, but what I'm wondering about, though, is Supreme Court rulings don't seem to be helping your cause. The 2008 ruling in D.C. against banning handguns possession and 2010 against a similar ban in Chicago are not exactly going in favor of the idea of gun control, quite
no.
The contrary.
First, to the representation. In my judgment, the NRA and other organizations like Gun Owners of America do everything that they can in order to promote a policy that could be summed up as any gun, anytime, anybody, any place. They deserve blame for taking that position and for fighting so hard for a position that I think is not in the best interest of American society. But to use the fact that there is a powerful opposition as a reason for justifying one's own failure to take action, which is what I think has become very commonplace, both among politicians and among the general public, is to sell our society short. Now, if I could come to your second point about the Supreme Court. Those decisions, the Heller decision that said one can have a firearm in one's home for self-protection, and the McDonald decision that said, and this applies to state law, those decisions were made by 5-4 majorities. And the four dissenters in Heller said in McDonald, we are dissenting here, and we still think Heller is wrong. A very smart law professor of mine, or lawyer who was a professor of mine, said once, and I think this is a very important point, the Constitution means what the Supreme Court says it means. This issue is not decided.
John Vileko.
Disagree with that last statement. The Constitution means what it says, and it says what it means, what the original intent of the Constitution was. And you know, sometimes the Supreme Court gets it right, sometimes they get it wrong, and we have to fix it. But it is in no way the final word. The Constitution is the final word over the Supreme Court. It's not the other way around.
Which is why nobody had any trouble at all figuring out what the language of the Second Amendment actually meant, I suppose.
Well, the Supreme Court got it right in the sense that you know, the Second Amendment protects an individual and not a collective right. And I think, you know, we have some qualms with the Heller decision as well, because it still did not use the Second Amendment as the standard of review for gun control laws, but rather left it wide open that anything short of a gun ban may or may not be acceptable. So, you know, it was a mixed decision as far as we're concerned.
Well, I want to bring some more of our callers in. David is next. David, you're on.
Hi. Yeah. So I am a gun-owning Democrat. I am for having. I do not feel safe in my neighborhood, and I would like to be able to carry a concealed weapon. But on the other hand, I feel like the NRA, a lot of the gun, other gun owners are going too far to the other extreme. I mean, the gentleman said, well, if we had had, you know, weapons inside the movie theater, we could have defended ourselves. That I agree with. But who is going to bring an assault weapon to a theater? Why do we need assault weapons? I think we should frame this debate by asking ourselves, what are the legitimate purposes of firearms, such as self-defense and hunting, but not these high-power militia guns? Will it be a perfect solution? No, but it might help.
Well, we go back to that argument, John Vileko. Why the need for essentially what is combat weaponry?
Well, just to restate it, it's not technically combat, but more to the point, you know, when GOA was founded in 1975 by actually a California state senator, H.L. Richardson, this country was debating a national ban on handguns. So that the not too long ago, the argument was completely the reverse, that we wanted to ban small, inexpensive handguns. They called them Saturday night specials. And that's how gun control really got started in the latter part of the 20th century. So when you start whittling away at classes of firearms, what we end up doing is sacrificing more and more of our liberty. We get it chipped away, but we won't become more safe as a society. And then the answer is, well, we need to do more of what wasn't working.
Why the certainty in this notion of the slippery slope? I mean, it's not a foregone conclusion that if you say weaponry that's used for war is outlawed or banned, that you would go immediately or somewhere down the line to handguns. That's what you've stated before. That's not necessarily an equation that is preconceived.
Well,
or for certain, is it?
Well, the idea of you know, banning, like let's say closing the so-called gun show loophole, and people will argue that you know, criminals and terrorists shouldn't be able to go to a gun show and buy a firearm without having a background check. And that sounds good, it's easy to say, but what's the solution? The solution is for the government to regulate all private sales. And meanwhile, you don't, I mean, I hope most people don't believe that, you know, a terrorist cell of Al-Qaeda is going to say, oh, darn, we could have gotten guns and now we can't get guns anymore because the Congress passed a law. And that's how it is with criminals and violence. It's going to impact the law-abiding, and it's going to impact the rights and liberties that this country was founded on.
This always comes into this argument, Garen Wintemute, that is, if criminals want guns just like narcotics,
yes,
there's a subterranean world, there's access to them, they'll get them.
Right.
But if law-abiding citizens can't get guns, and you know, this is kind of what I used to call talk show 101, you're keeping law-abiding citizens from protecting themselves.
Sure, but we're not. Here's how gun purchasing works now. And I will use gun shows as an example because it's where you can see this happening all in one place. If I want to buy a gun from a licensed retailer, it's got to be legal. I have to be willing to give my identity and make some certifications. There's some paperwork. A background check is done. Usually that takes about 2 minutes. But there's some paperwork. It's a hassle. But in most of the country, I can go to the next table where there can be a private individual, and I speak from experience. I have gone to something like 80 shows to collect the data for this, and there's a book at our website that people can look at about it.
You want to give your website, by the way?
Sure.
People will want to look at it.
Yep, it's www.UCDMC, short for UC Davis Medical Center, .ucdavis.edu/VPRP, the initials of Violence Prevention Research Program. I can go to the next table where there can be a private individual with the same inventory that the retailer has, there will be a little sign on that table that simply says private sale. Everybody at the gun show knows exactly what that means. Private sellers, if they represent that they are not in the business and they can be of selling guns and they can sell hundreds of guns and still get away with that claim, if the sale is from a private seller, there is no need to show identification. They may not, they cannot initiate a background check. It all happens in a matter of brief negotiations, cash, and a handshake. There is always a handshake.
So tell me specifically, if you could, and then we'll get response to what you're putting forward here from John Vallejo. What specific changes or regulations would you like to see, and would you like to see the presidential candidates go on the record?
Sure. First off, I think there should be a background check for all firearm sales, not just at gun shows. I would agree with Mr. Vallejo that there is no such thing in the law, at least as a gun show loophole. In California, we have already done this. We know that it works. Gun shows thrive in California, even though private sales have to go through a retailer. And the firearms market generally thrives in California. It's been described as lucrative. That's their term.
We're running
by the industry.
Short on time. I want to get a response from you, John Vallejo, on this, and also you might as well give out your website as well. I'm sure people want to learn more about your organization. Yeah,
I could have saved the doctor's 80 trips to gun shows, because that's something that we see all the time, and he's absolutely right, that private citizens possessing their individually held, constitutionally protected personal items, they do sell them to other private citizens, because those sales are not and should not be regulated by the federal government. And a gun show, it's just like, you know, if you have an auto dealer magazine that sells thousands of cars, where private citizens are selling their cars to other citizens. You know, that's not something that you have to go to the government for to get approval. So that's what we want to protect, that right of private citizens. You could go to gunowners.org for more information about GOA. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you both for your time, and I think you're both in favor of at least political candidates stating their positions here, whatever those positions might be. I think I'm speaking for what both of you have said here. Thank John Vallejo, who is Director of Federal Affairs for the Gun Owners of America, and thanks to Garen Wintemute, who is Director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis. Thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Judy Campbell and Vinny Tong. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.